good things to come instead of the true form of these realities. It can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins? But in these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body have you prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure." Then I said, "Behold, I have come to do your will, O God, as it is written of me in the scroll of the book." When he said above, "You have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings. These are offered according to the law." Then he added, "Behold, I have come to do your will." He does away with the first in order to establish the second. And by that will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified, and the Holy Spirit also bears witness to us, for after saying, "This is the covenant that I will make with them. After those days, declares the Lord, I will put my laws on their hearts and write them on their minds." Then he adds, "I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more. Where there is forgiveness of these sins, there is no longer any offering for sin."
Good morning. going to be continuing our series on worship this morning. Today, I'd like to take us, I guess, a step back, and together, I hope that we can consider, we can consider, you know, how it is that we enter in to worship. You know, how is it that we enter into the presence of God? So it's not so much what are we doing, I guess, during the service or during the singing, but what happens before it? And, you know, I guess you might be thinking, well, I guess generally before worship, I have iced coffee and maybe an Egg McMuffin if I have enough time. And, you know, I guess if that's the case, it's kind of confusing. Why would my pastor be so concerned about that? And it's true, I'm not concerned about your Egg McMuffin. Unless you have an extra one and you want to give it to me, then I am slightly more concerned. But in terms of worship, yeah, I don't think that my intention is to really pry into what you do with your Sunday mornings. I don't want to know. But I think that as we consider our passage, as we think about what the author of Hebrews is saying to us, you know, we come to understand that something important happens prior to our worship. Something essential must happen before we enter in to the very presence of God. As we consider this idea of preparing to come before the Almighty, I'd like to focus on three things. The first is the holiness of God. The second is the perfect righteousness of God. And the third is the sufficient grace of God. So holiness, righteousness, and grace. So with our first point, the holiness of God, I think to a certain degree, we're a little bit surprised by this idea that we need to prepare to come into the presence of God. I mean, there are praise songs that say things like, "Come just as you are," right? And so that sort of implies no preparation necessary, right? And, you know, I'm not implying that these praise songs are lying to you or anything like that, but I think that it's, that there might be something that we're missing. You know, we tend to kind of imagine, well, I mean, God is the ultimate Father, right? And that's biblical, that's true. And so we might think, well, if that's the case, isn't he always, I guess, you know, knocking on the door? Isn't he always kind of just waiting for a hug? You know, I'm a father, and I wait for hugs, okay? I ask my son, I say, Jonah, can I have a hug? And then he says, no. After which point I say, come on. And then he runs away. And, you know, isn't that what God is like? I mean, sometimes we don't run away, sometimes we do. But, you know, we kind of, yeah, maybe that's the picture that we have. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this film. There's this brilliant, amazing film called Napoleon Dynamite. Yeah, I know. Some of you don't think it's funny, and that's because you're not funny, okay? Yeah, that's right. But it's okay. I still like you. But either way, the film is extraordinary. Now, in this film, there's a young man named Pedro, and Pedro is running for student body president. His election speech is short and it's sweet. He says, vote for me and all your wildest dreams will come true. That's pretty, I mean, that's convincing, right? If vote for him and all your wildest dreams will come true, that sounds like a good deal. I want all my wildest dreams to come true, and he wants to be president, so, you know, it can work out that way. And, you know, I wonder if sometimes we think that God is some kind of spiritual politician. I mean, not like the greasy kind, but like, you know, the inspirational and good kind. That he's always begging and pleading that we would just accept him. And I wonder if we're more familiar with that God than with the holy, glorious God of all creation who asks us why he should accept us. Right? The God of the Bible is a God who is holy. And I don't know if you're, I guess, very familiar with the Old Testament or the Old Testament law. There's books with odd names like Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Maybe you've glanced through them, or maybe you've read them, and I will be pleasantly surprised. But either way, that's the whole point. The first five books of the Bible can be summarized in three words. God is holy. God is holy. And in the Israelites, they understood this. Our passage, it speaks about the law, about sacrifices, about the blood of bulls and goats. And I guess this side of the cross, we might be tempted to think, oh, you know, yeah, like all of those animal sacrifices, that kind of thing. Well, that's primitive. That's just this kind of, you know, silly religion that we modern people have moved beyond. But we have to remember, God told them to make the sacrifices. It was his commandment. He demanded sacrifice of his people. And, you know, it's not that the Old Testament God is different than the New Testament God. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Our passage, it refers particularly to this unique day. It's called the Day of Atonement. This day occurred once a year. You can find the details in Leviticus 16 if you're interested. But the gist of it is that one day out of the year, there would be one man, the high priest, and he would enter in to the inner room of the temple of God, the Holy of Holies, and he would offer sacrifice on behalf of the nation. This high priest, he was ritually cleansed multiple times during the day. He wore special garments that were created only for this day. He sacrificed bulls prior to going into the Holy of Holies in order to cover his own sin. And all of this elaborate, I guess, ceremony, it was just preparation for the actual ceremony that the priest was meant to perform. the Day of Atonement, it centered around a ceremony that involved two goats. Now, essentially, first, the high priest would pray over the goats, and he would symbolically transfer the guilt and the sin of the nation onto these two goats. The first goat was slaughtered, and it pointed to the fact that sin leads to death, and sin is paid for with blood. Now, the high priest would take some of the blood of that goat, and he would bring it into the Holy of Holies in order to sprinkle it on the altar. And before he went in, the other priest would tie a rope around his ankle. Now, the rope wasn't part of the ceremony. The rope was just in case the high priest offended God and God killed him, so they could pull him out if he was unable to walk out under his own power. The other priests understood they were not the high priest. They were not allowed into the Holy of Holies. Now, if the high priest went in and was able to come out without dying, he would then send the second goat away into the wilderness. And what this signified is that the Lord was removing the sin of the nation from among the people and sending it away. There's, you might recall the psalm that says, so far as the east is from the west, right, the Lord has separated us from our sin, right? And that's what is happening in this ceremony. And so we understand that we cannot take the presence of God lightly. We can't enter in flippantly. Right? Israel knew that God is holy. And for us to come into the presence of a holy God, we too need to be made holy ourselves. We tend to forget. God, yes, he is compassionate. He is kind. But he is also a consuming fire. The angels that are perfect, that have never disobeyed God, they cover their eyes in his presence because he is too holy for them to look upon. They cover their feet as a symbol of the fact that they are on holy ground. When Moses encountered the burning bush and God spoke to him, God said, "Remove your sandals, for you are on holy ground." When we enter in to Sunday worship, we are entering into holy ground. When we open our Bibles, when we begin to pray, we are stepping in to holy ground. Now, as we consider the fact that unholy people die in the presence of God, we ought to ask, how can I be prepared? How is it that you and I can be made good and righteous enough to come into the presence of God and live? Now, whether we realize it or not, we all have our own methods of doing so. Maybe it just kind of depends on how many quiet times we did, 4 out of 7, more than half, so this week I can come and worship. I tend to sit in the back in the seats reserved for parents and people who are really, really late. And we sit back there, and it's interesting. A lot of times people come in and they'll kind of sit and pray for a few moments before they begin to sing or before they begin to listen to the message, at least depending on how late they are. Usually they're here before the benediction. But yeah, there's kind of this sense. There's a sense that, okay, we need to sort of do something before we enter in. Now, the author of Hebrews, he's writing to Jewish Christians. And these particular Jewish Christians they're tempted to return to the sacrificial system. They're thinking, okay, God is holy, and there's got to be a way in, and maybe we should stick with the sacrifices and with the law. And I guess at first glance, you know, that's not the worst idea, because God himself instituted the law. And this is the law that governed the nation of Israel for over 2,000 years. So it's a lot better than, you know, something, I guess, that we made up, like, you know, 5 years ago or something, right? It seems to have at least some history behind it. But, you know, our passage, it very quickly shoots down this option. In verse 1, we find that the law that God himself ordained is a shadow. It's a shadow, and it can never make perfect those who draw near. Verse 2 essentially is saying that, you know, the sacrifices were insufficient. They had to be offered every single year. If they were effective, then it would be one and done. But instead, every single year, they needed to be offered again and again. Verse 4 is even more blunt than that. It says, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. Verse 3 is interesting because it says, in fact, these sacrifices that do not take away sin, what they actually do is remind us of our sin and failure before God. Every year the Israelites came and they were reminded, we are still not clean before God. Remember, this is the system that God himself created. The very best religious service that we can offer, it simply reminds us of how far we really are. See, the way to understand and appreciate the righteousness of God, it's not by, you know, thinking a lot about our weaknesses and our sin and then comparing it to the holiness of God. No, we understand a little bit more when we stand as tall as we can. And we bring our best, our strengths, the best prayers, the best acts of service, the best sacrifices, the best that we can bring, and we compare that to the perfect righteousness of Jesus Christ. It's then that we can begin to understand what holiness means. Now, when Kairos first started, I have a lot of fond memories from the beginning. I think that God has been very faithful, particularly when I consider that we were arrogant, to put it nicely. I do believe God wanted us to start this church, but I think we mistook that for meaning that we were good people able to start a church. We thought, you know, we're going to do it right. Because it's easy to look around at other churches and criticize and say, oh, they should have done it like this, or the leader should be like that, and, you know, We were pretty good at that. And we thought to ourselves, oh, we're going to do church the right way. And sure, is it hard to start a church plant, especially with college students who put change in the offering? Yes, it's hard. But we were clever enough. We were gifted enough. We were so holy that we could do it. And I mean, that's ridiculous. And it's not ridiculous just because of our flaws. And we had a lot, and we have a lot. We continue to have a lot. What makes it really ridiculous is when we consider, when I look back and think about our strengths. We were judging one another in prayer meeting. We were bickering and demanding our rights on mission trips. Our Christian friendships, more often than not, we were busy complaining about other leaders, far more so than we were thanking God for his goodness to sinners. See, our best, the best prayer that we have ever prayed, the best sacrifice that we have ever made, it earns us nothing but condemnation before God, because he is holy. You know, many of you were not with us for all 8 of those years. But I am certain that you have experienced numerous moral failures in the last 24 hours. And perhaps you've experienced some spiritual successes as well that were immediately ruined by self-righteousness and pride. And as we consider that, as we still, in our own mixed way, desire the presence of God. We want his blessing. We want his care. We want what he has to offer. And, you know, we have to ask, how is it possible? Who can stand before a righteous God? Who could be good enough? Who could know enough? Who could sacrifice enough? Who has a pure and righteous heart? When we're sane, we know that we are not that person. But luckily for us, there is one who came and obeyed the Father. We would not, but Jesus Christ did. In verses 5-7, the author of Hebrews, he quotes from Psalm 40, and he puts the words of the psalmist into the mouth of Jesus Christ. Essentially, Jesus says, I am better than burnt offerings. I am better than sacrifices, even sacrifices ordained by God. I am better. Why? Why is he better? Verse 7, behold, I have come to do your will, O God. The Son of God came and did the will of the Father. Philippians 2 puts it this way, that Jesus was obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Verse 10, it tells us that we've been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. What thousands of burnt offerings could not do, Jesus did. In verse 11, we read that the priests, the high priest, they would stand daily offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. There were many priests that gave many sacrifices, and they continually stood because their work was never done. But verse 12, Jesus Christ, the one true high priest, the God-man, he came and made one sacrifice, and he sat down at the right hand of God because his work was finished. You know, the priests, they offered bulls and goats. The Father gave us his Son. The most majestic, beautiful, glorious, loving being in existence suffered and died for us. And the author of Hebrews, he's just shocked. He's saying to his fellow Christians, how can you go back? How can you go back to bulls and goats? How can we rely on our own methods to enter into the presence of God? How can we, you know, sanctify our song order or the right kind of prayer that we're going to pray or the tithe that we give? How can we compare that to the precious blood of Jesus Christ? How can we boast of anything that we possess or ever could possess in light of the goodness of God? The Son of God, he came. He came to give us what only he could give us. Verse 16. I will put my laws on their hearts and write them on their minds. Jesus comes to make us into new people, new hearts, new minds. And last week, Pastor Sam, he was preaching about how real worship is when our lips, the praise on our lips, connects with the praise in our hearts. Jesus died to make that happen. Because no matter how much we guilt ourselves, no matter how much we discipline ourselves, we cannot make ourselves into people that delight in living and dying for God. But we are blessed that the Son of God gave his life that we could be people that can worship. Verse 17, Jesus gives to us free and full forgiveness. I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more. Jesus dies that we might be free. No more guilt, no more shame, nothing to hide. And these things, if we understand them rightly, they're too good to be true. We imagine that, you know, what all of this is, the sacrifice of the Son of God, our Christian faith, we imagine that it can't be that free. You know, when Kairos first started, I missed the majority of that first year. I was not far away. Very likely, I was sleeping in my room. I wasn't going to church at the time. I was struggling with a lot of sin, a lot of bitterness. A lot was going on. And, you know, eventually I did come back. You know, I knew the Bible was true. I knew that God was real. And so, I came back. And, you know, I began to, go to prayer meetings again and, small group. Well, I don't know if it's a group. It was like me and Fred alone in his apartment. Whatever that is called. And I was, getting more involved again, signed up for a mission trip, this kind of thing. And, I was sorry. I was genuinely remorseful. And, I would tell God, I want to make it up to you. I'm going to do it right this time. I'm not going to mess it up. I'm asking him for a second chance. But thankfully, that's not the way it works. Jesus Christ did not die simply to give us a second chance. On the cross, he did not shout, "Try again. Try harder. Don't mess it up this time." He declared, "It is finished." And those are two very different things. The story of our lives, the story of this church, the story of the scriptures, and of all of human history, it is not. We will learn from our mistakes and do better. No. It is better than that. The Bible tells us that God is faithful. His people will fail. His people will betray him. His people are fickle and unreliable, but God is faithful, and he will fulfill his promises. The Son of God does not come and die on a cross in order to, just help us out a little bit. No, he conquers sin and death. He defeats them and sits down because his work is done. He's just waiting. He's just waiting for everything to happen as he has commanded. The Lord of all, he will get his glory. And you and I, we are invited to receive the person and work of Jesus Christ, that on the last day we might join the nations and be in the very presence of God, face to face, not through a veil, face to face, and we will worship. We're taking communion today, and as we prepare our hearts, the question that we need to ask is not, "Have I been good enough lately to earn the love of God. We are not asking if we've done enough to deserve to be in his presence. No. The real question that we need to ask, it's, is there a God who is powerful enough and gracious enough to save sinners? Yeah, praise team.